horrible and slow and deep. "Let me help you, dear. Oh, I am so sorry." She struck out at her. Flex. And Miss Desjardins went flying to rattle off the wall at the side of the stage and fall into a heap. Carrie ran. She ran through the middle of them. Her hands were to her face, but she could see through the prison of her fingers, could see them, how they were, beautiful, wrapped in light, swathed in the bright, angelic robes of acceptance. The shine shoes, the clear faces, the careful beauty parlor hairdos, the glittery gowns. They stepped back from her as if she was plague, but they kept laughing. Then a foot was stuck slyly out. Oh, yes, that comes next, oh, yes. And she fell on her hands and knees and began to crawl along the floor with her blood-clotted hair hanging in her face, crawling like St. Paul on the Damascus Road, whose eyes had been blinded by the light. Next, someone would kick her ass. But no one did. And then she was scrabbling to her feet again. Things began to speed up. She was out through the door, out into the lobby, then flying down the stairs that she and Tommy had swept up so grandly 2 hours ago. Tommy's dead. Full price paid. Full price for bringing a plague into the place of light. She went down them in great, awkward leaps, with the sound of the laughter flapping around her like blackbirds. Then, darkness. She fled across the school's wide front lawn, losing both of her prom slippers and fleeing barefoot. The closely cut school lawn was like velvet, lightly dusted with dewfall, and the laughter was behind her. She began to calm slightly. Then her feet did tangle, and she fell at full length out by the flagpole. She lay quiescent, breathing raggedly, her hot face buried in the cool grass. The tears of shame began to flow, as hot and as heavy as that first flow of menstrual blood had been. They had beaten her, bested her, once and for all time. It was over. She would pick herself up very soon now and sneak home by the back streets, keeping to the shadows in case someone came looking for her. Find Mama. Admit she had been wrong. No. The steel in her, and there was a great deal of it, suddenly rose up and cried the word out strongly. The closet? The endless wandering prayers? The tracks? And the cross, and only the mechanical bird and the Black Forest cuckoo clock to mark off the rest of the hours and days and years and decades of her life? Suddenly, as if a videotape machine had been turned on in her mind, she saw Miss Desjardins running toward her, and saw her thrown out of her way like a rag doll as she used her mind on her without even consciously thinking of it. She rolled over on her back, eyes staring wildly at the stars from her painted face. She was forgetting the power. It was time to teach them a lesson, time to show them a thing or two. She giggled hysterically. It was one of Mama's pet phrases. Mama coming home, putting her purse down, eyeglasses flashing. Well, I guess I showed that elf a thing or two at the shop today. There was the sprinkler system. She could turn it on easily. She giggled again and got up, began to walk barefoot back toward the lobby doors. Turn on the sprinkler system and close all the doors. Look in and let them see her looking in, watching and laughing, while the shower ruined their dresses and their hairdos and took the shine off their shoes. Her only regret was that it couldn't be blood. The lobby was empty. She paused halfway up the stairs, and flex. The doors all slammed shut under the concentrated force she directed at them. the pneumatic door closers snapping off. She heard some of them scream, and it was music. Sweet soul music. For a moment, nothing changed, and then she could feel them pushing against the doors, wanting them to open. The pressure was negligible. They were trapped. Trapped. And the word echoed intoxicatingly in her mind. They were under her thumb, in her power. Power. What a word that was. She went the rest of the way up and looked in, and George Dawson was smashed up against the glass, struggling, pushing, his face distorted with effort. There were others behind him, and they all looked like fish in an aquarium. She glanced up, and yes, there were the sprinkler pipes with their tiny nozzles like metal daisies. The pipes went through small holes in the green cinder block wall. There was a great many inside, she remembered. Fire laws or something. Fire laws. In a flash, her mind recalled. Black, thick cords like snakes. The power cords strung all over the stage. They were out of the audience's sight, hidden by the footlights, but she had had to step carefully over them to get to the throne. Tommy had been holding her arm. Fire and water. She reached up with her mind, felt the pipes, traced them. Cold, full of water. She tasted iron in her mouth. Cold, wet metal. The taste of water drunk from the nozzle of a garden hose. Flex. For a moment, nothing happened. Then they began to back away from the doors, looking around. She walked to the small oblong of glass in the middle door and looked inside. It was raining in the gym. Carrie began to smile. She hadn't gotten all of them, only some. But she found that by looking up at the sprinkler system with her eyes, she could trace its course more easily with her mind. She began to turn on more of the nozzles, and more. Yet it wasn't enough. They weren't crying yet, so it wasn't enough. Hurt them, then. Hurt them. There was a boy up on stage by Tommy, gesturing wildly and shouting something. As she watched, he climbed down and ran toward the rock band's equipment. He caught hold of one of the microphone stands and was transfixed. Carrie watched, amazed, as his body went through a nearly motionless dance of electricity. His feet shuffled in the water, his hair stood up in spikes, and his mouth jerked open like the mouth of a fish. He looked funny. She began to laugh. By Christ, then, let them all look funny. And in a sudden blind thrust, she yanked at all the power she could feel. Some of the lights puffed out. There was a dazzling flash somewhere as a live power cord hit a puddle of water. There were dull thumps in her mind as circuit breakers went into hopeless operation. The boy who had been holding the mic stand fell over on one of his amps, and there was an explosion of purple sparks, and then the crepe bunting that faced the stage was burning. Just below the thrones, a live 220-volt electricity cable was crackling on the floor, and beside it, Rhonda Simmerd was doing a crazed puppet dance in her green tulle formal. Its full skirt suddenly blazed into flame, and she fell forward, still jerking. It might have been at that moment that Carrie went over the edge. She leaned against the doors, her heart pumping wildly, yet her body as cold as ice cubes. Her face was livid, but dull red fever spots stood on each cheek. Her head throbbed thickly, and conscious thought was lost. She reeled away from the door, still holding them shut, doing it without thought or plan. Inside, the fire was brightening, and she realized dimly that the mural must have caught on fire. She collapsed on the top step and put her head down on her knees, trying to slow her breathing. They were trying to get out the doors again, but she held them shut easily. That alone was no strain. Some obscure sense told her that a few were getting out the fire doors, but let them. She would get them later. She would get all of them. Every last one. She went down the stairs slowly and out the front doors, still holding the gymnasium doors closed. It was easy. All you had to do was see them in your mind. The town whistle went off suddenly, making her scream and put her hands in front of her face. The whistle. It's just the fire whistle. For a moment, her mind's eye lost sight of the gymnasium doors, and some of them almost got out. No. No. Naughty. She slammed them shut again, catching somebody's fingers. It felt like Dale Norbert in the jam and severing one of them. She began to reel across the lawn again, a scarecrow figure with bulging eyes, toward Main Street. On her right was downtown, the department store, the Kelly Fruit, the beauty parlor and barber shop, gas stations, police station, fire station. They'll put out my fire. But they wouldn't. She began to giggle, and it was an insane sound. Triumphant, lost, victorious, terrified. She came to the first hydrant and tried to twist the huge painted lug nut on the side. Ooh! It was heavy. It was very heavy. Metal twisted tight to balk her. Didn't matter. She twisted harder and felt it give. Then the other side. Then the top. Then she twisted all three at once, standing back, and they unscrewed in a flash. Water exploded outward and upward, one of the lug nuts flying 5 feet in front of her at suicidal speed. It hit the street, caromed high into the air, and was gone. Water gushed with white pressure in a cruciform pattern. Smiling, staggering, her heart beating at over 200 per minute, she began to walk down toward Grass Plaza. She was unaware that she was scrubbing her bloodied hands against a dress like Lady Macbeth, or that she was weeping even as she laughed, or that one hidden part of her mind was keening over her final and utter ruin. Because she was going to take them with her, and there was going to be a great burning, until the land was full of its stink. She opened the hydrant at Grass Plaza, and then began to walk down to Teddy's Amoco. It happened to be the first gas station she came to, but it was not the last. From the sworn testimony of Sheriff Otis Doyle, taken before the State Investigatory Board of Maine, from the White Commission report, pages 29 through 31. Question, Sheriff, where were you on the night of May 27th? Answer, I was on Route 179, known as Old Benton Road, investigating an automobile accident. This was actually over the Chamberlain Town line and into Durham, but I was assisting Mel Crager, who is the Durham constable. Question, when were you first informed that trouble had broken out at Ewan High School? Answer, I received a radio transmission from Officer Jacob Plessy at 10:21. Question, what was the nature of the radio call? Answer, Officer Plessy said there was trouble at the school, but he didn't know if it was serious or not. There was a lot of shouting going on, he said, and someone had pulled a couple of fire alarms. He said he was going over to try and determine the nature of the trouble. Question, did he say the school was on fire? Answer, no, sir. Question, did you ask him to report back to you? Answer, I did. Question, did Officer Plessy report back? Answer, no. He was killed in the subsequent explosion of Teddy's Amoco gas station on the corner of Main and Summer. Question. When did you next have a radio communication concerning Chamberlain? Answer. At 10:42. I was at that time returning to Chamberlain with a suspect in the back of my car, a drunk driver. As I have said, the case was actually in Mel Crager's town, but Durham has no jail. When I got him to Chamberlain, we didn't have much of one either. Question. What communication did you receive at 10:42? Answer. I got a call from the state police that had been relayed from the Mottin Fire Department. The state police dispatcher said there was a fire and an apparent riot at Ewan High School and a probable explosion. No one was sure of anything at that time. Remember, it all happened in a space of 40 minutes. Question. We understand that, Sheriff. What happened then? Answer. I drove back to Chamberlain with Siren and Flasher. I was trying to raise Jake Plessy and not having any luck. That's when Tom Quillen came on and started to babble about the whole town going up in flames and no water. Question. Do you know what time that was? Answer. Yes, sir. I was keeping a record by then. It was 10:58. Question. Quillen claims the Amoco station exploded at 11 o'clock. Answer. I'd take the average, sir. Call it 10:59. Question. At what time did you arrive in Chamberlain? Answer. At 11:10 p.m. Question. What was your immediate impression upon arriving, Sheriff Doyle? Answer. I was stunned. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Question. What exactly were you seeing? Answer. The entire upper half of the town's business section was burning. The Amoco station was gone. Woolworth's was nothing but a blazing frame. The fire had spread to three wooden storefronts next to that. Duffy's Bar and Grill, the Kelly Fruit Company, and the billiard parlor. The heat was ferocious. Sparks were flying onto the roofs of the Maitland Real Estate Agency and Doug Brand's Western Auto Store. Fire trucks were coming in, but they could do very little. Every fire hydrant on that side of the street was stripped. The only trucks doing any business at all were two old volunteer fire department pumpers from Westover, and about all they could do was wet the roofs of the surrounding buildings. And, of course, the high school, it was just gone. Of course, it's fairly isolated. Nothing close enough to it to burn. But, my God, all those kids inside. All those kids. Question. Did you meet Susan Snell upon entering town? Answer. Yes, sir. She flagged me down. Question. What time was this? Answer. Just as I entered town. 11:12, no later. Question. What did she say? Answer. She was distraught. She'd been in a minor car accident, skidding, and she was barely making sense. She asked me if Tommy was dead. I asked her who Tommy was, but she didn't answer. She asked me if we had caught Carrie yet. Question. The commission is extremely interested in this part of your testimony, Sheriff Doyle. Answer. Yes, sir. I know that. Question. How did you respond to her question? Answer. Well, there's only one Carrie in town as far as I know, and that's Margaret White's daughter. I asked her if Carrie had something to do with the fires. Miss Snell told me Carrie had done it. Those were her words. Carrie did it. Carrie did it. She said it twice. Question. Did she say anything else? Answer. Yes, sir. She said, they've hurt Carrie for the last time. Question. Sheriff, are you sure she didn't say, we've hurt Carrie for the last time? Answer. I am quite sure. Question. Are you positive? 100%? Answer. Sir, the town was burning around our heads. Question. Had she been drinking? Answer. I beg pardon? Question. Had she been drinking? You said she had been involved in a car smash. Answer. I believe I said a minor skidding accident. Question. And you can't be sure she didn't say we instead of they? Answer. I guess she might have, but... Question. What did Miss Snell do then? Answer. She burst into tears. I slapped her. Question. Why did you do that? Answer. She seemed hysterical. Question. Did she quiet eventually? Answer. Yes, sir. She quieted down and got control of herself pretty well, in light of the fact that her boyfriend was probably dead. Question. Did you interrogate her? Answer. Well, not the way you'd interrogate a criminal, if that's what you mean. I asked her if she knew anything about what had happened. She repeated what she had already said, but in a calmer way. I asked her where she had been when the trouble began, and she told me that she had been at home. Question. Did you interrogate her further? Answer. No, sir. Question. Did she say anything else to you? Answer. Yes, sir. She asked me, begged me, to find Carrie White. Question. What was your reaction to that? Answer. I told her to go home. Question. Thank you, Sheriff Doyle. Vic Mooney lurched out of the shadows near the Bankers Trust drive-in office with a grin on his face. It was a huge and awful grin, a Cheshire cat grin, floating dreamily in the fire-shot darkness like a trace memory of lunacy. His hair, carefully slicked down for his MC duties, was now sticking up in a crow's nest. Tiny drops of blood were branded across his forehead from some unremembered fall in his mad flight from the spring ball. One eye was swelled purple and screwed shut. He walked into Sheriff Doyle's squad car, bounced back like a pool ball, and grinned in at the drunk driver dozing in the back. Then he turned to Doyle, who had just finished with Sue Snell. The fire cast wavering shadows of light across everything, turning the world into the maroon tones of dried blood. As Doyle turned, Vic Mooney clutched him. He clutched Doyle as an amorous swain might clutch his lady in a hug dance. He clutched Doyle with both arms and squeezed him, all the while goggling upward into Doyle's face with his great, crazed grin. "Vic," Doyle began. "She pulled all the plugs," Vic said lightly, grinning. "Pulled all the plugs and turned on the water and buzz, buzz, buzz." "Vic, we can't let 'em." "Oh, no, 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 we can't. Carrie pulled all the plugs. Rhonda simmered, burn up. Oh, Jesus!" Doyle slapped him twice, calloused palm cracking flatly on the boy's face. The scream died with shocking suddenness, but the grin remained, like an echo of evil. It was loose and terrible. "What happened?" Doyle said roughly. "What happened at the school?" "Carrie," Vic muttered. "Carrie happened at the school. She..." He trailed off and grinned at the ground. Doyle gave him three brisk shakes. Vic's teeth clicked together like castanets. "What about Carrie?" "Queen of the prom," Vic muttered. "They dumped blood on her and Tommy." "What?" It was 11:15. Tony's sit-go on Summers suddenly exploded with a great coughing roar. The street went daylight that made them both stagger back against the police car and shield their eyes. A huge, oily cloud of fire climbed over the elms in Courthouse Park, lighting the duck pond and the Little League diamond in scarlet. Amid the hungry, crackling roar that followed, Doyle could hear glass and wood and hunks of gas station cinder block rattling back to earth. A secondary explosion followed, making them wince again. He still couldn't get it straight. "My town. This is happening in my town." that this was happening in Chamberlain. In Chamberlain, for God's sake, where he drank iced tea on his mother's sun porch and refereed PAL basketball and made one last cruise out Route 6 past the Cavalier before turning up at 2:30 every morning. His town was burning up. Tom Quillen came out of the police station and ran down the sidewalk to Doyle's cruiser. His hair was standing up every which way. He was dressed in dirty green work fatigues and an undershirt, and he had his loafers on the wrong feet. But Doyle thought he had never been so glad to see anyone in his life. Tom Quillen was as much Chamberlain as anything, and he was here, intact. "Holy God," he panted. "Did you see that?" "What's been happening?" Doyle asked curtly. "I've been monitoring the radio," Quillen said. "Motten and Westover wanted to know if they should send ambulances, and I said, hell yes, send everything. Hearses, too. Did I do right?" "Yes." Doyle ran his hands through his hair. "Have you seen Harry Block?" Block was the town's commissioner of public utilities, and that included water. "Nope. But Chief Dayan says they got water in the old Rennet block across town. They're laying hose now. I collared some kids, and they're setting up a hospital in the police station. They're good boys, but they're going to get blood on your floor, Otis." Otis Doyle felt unreality surge over him. Surely this conversation couldn't be happening in Chamberlain. Couldn't. "That's all right, Tommy. You did right. You go back there and start calling every doctor in the phone book. I'm going over to Summer Street." "Okay, Otis. If you see that crazy broad, be careful." "Who?" Doyle was not a barking man, but now he did. Tom Quillen flinched back. Carrie White." "Who? How do you know?" Quillen blinked slowly. "I don't know. It just sort of came to me." From the National AP ticker, 11:46 p.m. Chamberlain, Maine, AP. "A disaster of major proportions has struck the town of Chamberlain, Maine, tonight. A fire believed to have begun at Ewan High School during a school dance has spread to the downtown area, resulting in multiple explosions that have leveled much of the downtown area. A residential area to the west of the downtown area is also reported to be burning. However, most concern at this time is over the high school where a junior-senior prom was being held. It is believed that many of the prom-goers were trapped inside. A Westover fire official summoned to the scene said the known total of dead stood at 67, most of them high school students. Ask how high the total might go, he said. We don't know. We're afraid to guess. This is going to be worse than the Coconut Grove. At last report, three fires were raging out of control in the town. Reports of possible arson are unconfirmed. Ends." 11:46 p.m., May 27, 8943F, AP. There were no more AP reports from Chamberlain. At 12:06 a.m., a Jackson Avenue gas main was opened. At 12:17, an ambulance attendant from Motten tossed out a cigarette butt as the rescue vehicle sped toward Summer Street. The explosion destroyed nearly half a block at a stroke, including the offices of the Chamberlain Clarion. By 12:18 a.m., Chamberlain was cut off from the country that slept in reason beyond. At 12:10, still 7 minutes before the gas main explosion, the telephone exchange experienced a softer explosion. A complete jam of every town phone line still in operation. The three harried girls on duty stayed at their posts, but were utterly unable to cope. They worked with expressions of wooden horror on their faces, trying to place unplaceable calls. And so Chamberlain drifted into the streets. They came like an invasion from the graveyard, that lay in the elbow crook formed by the intersection of the Bell Squeeze Road and Route 6. They came in white nightgowns and in robes, as if in winding shrouds. They came in pajamas and curlers. Mrs. Dawson, she of the now-deceased son, who had been a very funny fellow, came in a mud pack, as if dressed for a minstrel show. They came to see what happened to their town, to see if it was indeed lying burned and bleeding. Many of them also came to die. Carlin Street was thronged with them, a riptide of them, moving downtown through the hectic light in the sky, when Carrie came out of the Carlin Street Congregational Church, where she had been praying. She had gone in only 5 minutes before, after opening the gas main. It had been easy. As soon as she pictured it lying there under the street, it had been easy. But it seemed like hours. She had prayed long and deeply, sometimes aloud, sometimes silently. Her heart thudded and labored. The veins on her face and neck bulged. Her mind was filled with a huge knowledge of powers and of an abyss. She prayed in front of the altar, kneeling in her wet and torn and bloody gown, her feet bare and dirty and bleeding from a broken bottle she had stepped on. Her breath sobbed in and out of her throat, and the church was filled with groanings and swayings and sunderings as psychic energy sprang from her. Pews fell, hymnals flew, and a silver communion set cruised silently across the voluted darkness of the nave to crash into the far wall. She prayed, and there was no answer. No one was there, or if there was, it was cowering from her. God had turned his face away, and why not? This horror was as much his doing as hers, and so she left the church, left it to go home and find her mama and make destruction complete. She paused on the lower step, looking at the flocks of people streaming toward the center of town. Animals, let them burn then. Let the streets be filled with the smell of their sacrifice. Let this place be called Raqqa, Ichabod, Wormwood, Flex. And power transformers atop light poles bloomed into nacreous purple light, spitting Catherine wheel sparks. High tension wires fell into the streets in pickup sticks tangles, and some of them ran, and that was bad for them, because now the whole street was littered with wires, and the stink began. The burning began. People began to scream and back away, and some touched the cables and went into jerky electrical dances. Some had already slumped into the street, their robes and pajamas smoldering. Carrie turned back and looked fixedly at the church she had just left. The heavy door suddenly swung shut as if in a hurricane wind. Carrie turned toward home. From the sworn testimony of Mrs. Cora Simmerd, taken before the State Investigatory Board, from the White Commission report, pages 217 through 218. Question. Mrs. Simmerd, the board understands that you lost your daughter on prom night, and we sympathize with you deeply. We will make this as brief as possible. Answer. Thank you. I want to help if I can, of course. Question. Were you on Carlin Street at approximately 12:12 when Carrietta White came out of the First Congregational Church on that street? Answer. Yes. Question. Why were you there? Answer. My husband had to be in Boston over the weekend on business, and Rhonda was at the spring ball. I was home alone watching TV and waiting up for her. I was watching the Friday night movie when the town hall whistle went off, but I didn't connect that with the dance. But then the explosion. I didn't know what to do. I tried to call the police but got a busy signal after the first three numbers. Then Question. Take your time, Mrs. Simmerd. All the time you need. Answer. I was getting frantic. There was a second explosion. Teddy's Amoco station, I know now. And I decided to go downtown and see what was happening. There was a glow in the sky. An awful glow. That was when Mrs. Shires pounded on the door. Question. Mrs. Georgette Shires? Answer. Yes, they live around the corner. 217 Willow. That's just off Carlin Street. She was pounding and calling. Cora, are you in there? Are you in there? I went to the door. She was in her bathrobe and slippers. Her feet looked cold. She said they had called Westover to see if they knew anything, and they told her the school was on fire. I said, Oh, dear God, Rhonda's at the dance. Question. Is this when you decided to go downtown with Mrs. Shires? Answer. We didn't decide anything. We just went. I put on a pair of slippers. Rhonda's, I think. They had little white puffballs on them. I should have worn my shoes, but I wasn't thinking. I guess I'm not thinking now. What do you want to hear about my shoes for? Question. You tell it in your own way, Mrs. Simmerd. Answer. Thank you. I gave Mrs. Shire some old jacket that was around, and we went. Question. Were there many people walking down Carlin Street? Answer. I don't know. I was too upset. Maybe 30, maybe more. Question. What happened? Answer. Georgette and I were walking toward Main Street, holding hands just like two little girls walking across a meadow after dark. Georgette's teeth were clicking. I remember that. I wanted to ask her to stop clicking her teeth, but I thought it would be impolite. A block and a half from the Congo Church, I saw the door open, and I thought, someone has gone in to ask God's help. But a second later, I knew that wasn't true. Question, how did you know? It would be logical to assume just what you first assumed, wouldn't it? Answer, I just knew. Question, did you know the person who came out of the church? Answer, yes, it was Carrie White. Question, had you ever seen Carrie White before? Answer, no, she was not one of my daughter's friends. Question, had you ever seen a picture of Carrie White? Answer, no. Question, and in any case, it was dark and you were a block and a half from the church. Answer, yes, sir. Question, Mrs. Simmerd, how did you know it was Carrie White? Answer, I just knew. Question, this knowing, Mrs. Simmerd, was it like a light going on in your head? Answer, no, sir. Question, what was it like? Answer, I can't tell you. It faded away the way a dream does. An hour after you get up, you can only remember you had a dream. But I knew. Question, was there an emotional feeling that went with this knowledge? Answer, yes. Horror. Question, what did you do then? Answer, I turned to Georgette and said, There she is. Georgette said, Yes, that's her. She started to say something else, and then the whole street was lit up by a bright glow, and there were crackling noises, and then the power lines started to fall into the street, some of them spitting live sparks. One of them hit a man in front of us, and he burst into flames. Another man started to run, and he stepped on one of them, and his body just arched backwards as if his back had turned into elastic. And then he fell down. Other people were screaming and running, just running blindly, and more cables fell. They were strung all over the place like snakes, and she was glad about it. Glad. I could feel her being glad. I knew I had to keep my head. The people who were running were getting electrocuted. Georgette said, Quick, Cora. Oh, God, I don't want to get burned alive. I said, Stop that. We have to use our heads, Georgette, or we'll never use them again. Something foolish like that, but she wouldn't listen. She let go of my hand and started to run for the sidewalk. I screamed at her to stop. There was one of those heavy main cables broken off right in front of us, but she didn't listen, and Oh, I could smell her when she started to burn. Smoke just seemed to burst out of her clothes, and I thought, that's what it must be like when someone gets electrocuted. The smell was sweet, like pork. Have any of you ever smelled that? Sometimes I smell it in my dreams. I stood dead still, watching Georgette Shires turn black. There was a big explosion over in the West End. The gas main, I suppose. But I never even noticed it. I looked around and I was all alone. Everyone else had either run away or was burning. I saw maybe 6 bodies. They were like piles of old rags. One of the cables had fallen under the porch of a house to the left, and it was catching on fire. I could hear the old-fashioned shake shingles popping like corn. It seemed like I stood there a long time, telling myself to keep my head. It seemed like hours. I began to be afraid that I would faint and fall on one of the cables, or that I would panic and start to run, like Georgette. So I started to walk, one step at a time. The street got even brighter because of the burning house. I stepped over 2 live wires and went around a body that wasn't much more than a puddle. I had to look to see where I was going. There was a wedding ring on the body's hand, but it was all black. All black! Jesus, I was thinking. Oh, dear Lord. I stepped over another cable, and then there were 3 all at once. I just stood there looking at them. I thought if I got over those, I'd be all right. But I didn't dare. Do you know what I kept thinking of? That game you play when you're kids. Giant step. A voice in my mind was saying, Cora, take one giant step over the live wires in the street. And I was thinking, may I? May I? One of them was still spitting a few sparks, but the other 2 looked dead. But you can't tell. The 3rd rail looks dead, too. So I stood there, waiting for someone to come, and nobody did. The house was still burning, and the flames had spread to the lawn and the trees and the hedge beside it, but no fire trucks came. Of course they didn't. The whole west side was burning up by that time. And I felt so faint. And at last I knew it was take the giant step or faint. And so I took it, as big a giant step as I could, and the heel of my slipper came down not an inch from the last wire. Then I got over and went around the end of 1 more wire, and then I started to run. And that's all I remember. When morning came, I was lying on a blanket in the police station with a lot of other people. Some of them, a few, were kids in their prom get-ups, and I started to ask them if they had seen Rhonda, and they said, they said, a short recess. Question, you are personally sure that Carrie White did this? Answer, yes. Question, thank you, Mrs. Simmard. Answer, I'd like to ask a question, if you please. Question, of course. Answer, what happens if there are others like her? What happens to the world? From The Shadow Exploded, page 151. By 12:45 on the morning of May 28th, the situation in Chamberlain was critical. The school had burned itself out on a fairly isolated piece of ground, but the entire downtown area was ablaze. Almost all the city water in that area had been tapped, but enough was available at low pressure from Dayan Street water mains to save the business buildings below the intersection of Main and Oak Streets. The explosion of Tony's Sitco on Upper Summer Street had resulted in a ferocious fire that was not to be controlled until nearly 10 o'clock that morning. There was water on Summer Street. There simply were no firemen or firefighting equipment to utilize it. Equipment was then on its way from Lewiston, Auburn, Lisbon, and Brunswick, but nothing arrived until 1 o'clock. On Carlin Street, an electrical fire caused by down power lines had begun. It was to eventually gut the entire north side of the street, including the bungalow where Margaret White gave birth to her daughter. On the west end of town, just below what is commonly called Brickyard Hill, the worst disaster had taken place, the explosion of a gas main and a resulting fire that raged out of control through most of the next day. And if we look at these flashpoints on a municipal map, see page facing, we can pick out Carrie's route, a wandering, looping path of destruction through the town, but one with an almost certain destination. Home. Something toppled over in the living room, and Margaret White straightened up, cocking her head to one side. The butcher knife glittered dully in the light of the flames. The electric power had gone off some time before, and the only light in the house came from the fire up the street. One of the pictures fell from the wall with a thump. A moment later, the Black Forest cuckoo clock fell. The mechanical bird gave a small, strangled squawk and was still. From the town, the sirens whooped endlessly, but she could still hear the footsteps when they turned up the walk. The door blew open, steps in the hall. She heard the plaster plaques in the living room, Christ, the unseen guest. What would Jesus do? The hour draweth nigh. If tonight became judgment, would you be ready? Explode one after the other, like plaster birds in a shooting gallery. Oh, I've been there and seen the harlots shimmy on wooden stages. She sat up on her stool like a very bright scholar who has gone to the head of the class, but her eyes were deranged. The living room windows blew outward. The kitchen door slammed, and Carrie walked in. Her body seemed to have become twisted, shrunken, crone-like. The prom dress was in tatters and flaps, and the pig blood had begun to clot and streak. There was a smudge of grease on her forehead, and both knees were scraped and raw-looking. "Mama," she whispered. Her eyes were preternaturally bright, hawk-like, but her mouth was trembling. If someone had been there to watch, he would have been struck by the resemblance between them. Margaret White sat on her kitchen stool, the carving knife hidden among the folds of her dress in her lap. "I should have killed myself when he put it in me," she said clearly. "After the first time, before we were married, he promised. Never again. He said we just slipped. I believed him. I fell down and I lost the baby, and that was God's judgment. I felt that the sin had been expiated by blood. But sin never dies. Sin never dies." Her eyes glittered. "Mama, at first it was all right. We lived sinlessly. We slept in the same bed, belly to belly sometimes, and, oh, I could feel the presence of the serpent. But we never did until..." She began to grin, and it was a hard, terrible grin. "And that night I could see him looking at me that way. We got down on our knees to pray for strength, and he touched me in that place, that woman place. And I sent him out of the house. He was gone for hours, and I prayed for him. I could see him in my mind's eye, walking the midnight streets, wrestling with the devil as Jacob wrestled with the angel of the Lord. And when he came back, my heart was filled with thanksgiving. She paused, grinning her dry, spitless grin into the shifting shadows of the room. "Mama, I don't want to hear it." Plates began to explode in the cupboards like clay pigeons. "It wasn't until he came in that I smelled the whiskey on his breath, and he took me, with the stink of filthy roadhouse whiskey still on him, he took me, and I liked it." She screamed out the last words at the ceiling. "I liked it. Oh, all that dirty fucking and his hands on me, all over me. Mama! Mama!" She broke off as if slapped and blinked at her daughter. "I almost killed myself," she said in a more normal tone of voice. "And Ralph wept and talked about atonement, and I didn't. And then he was dead. And then I thought God had visited me with a cancer, that he was turning my female parts into something as black and rotten as my sinning soul. But that would have been too easy. The Lord works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. I see that now. When the pains began, I went and got a knife, this knife." She held it up and waited for you to come so I could make my sacrifice. "But I was weak and backsliding. I took this knife in hand again when you were 3, and I backslid again. So now the devil has come home." She held the knife up, and her eyes fastened hypnotically on the glittering hook of its blade. Carrie took a slow, blundering step forward. "I came to kill you, Mama. And you were waiting here to kill me. Mama, it's not right, Mama. It's not..." "Let's pray," Mama said softly, her eyes fixed on Carrie's, and there was a crazed, awful compassion in them. The firelight was brighter now, dancing on the walls like dervishes. "For the last time, let us pray." "Oh, Mama, help me," Carrie cried out. She fell forward on her knees, head down, hands raised in supplication. Mama leaned forward, and the knife came down in a shining arc. Carrie, perhaps seeing out of the tail of her eye, jerked back, and instead of penetrating her back, the knife went into her shoulder to the hilt. Mama's feet tangled in the legs of her chair, and she collapsed in a sitting sprawl. They stared at each other in silent tableau. Blood began to ooze from around the handle of the knife and to splash onto the floor. Then Carrie said softly, "I'm going to give you a present, Mama." Margaret tried to get up, staggered, and fell back on her hands and knees. "What are you doing?" she croaked hoarsely. "I'm picturing your heart, Mama," Carrie said. "It's easier when you see things in your mind. Your heart is a big red muscle. Mine goes faster when I use my power, but yours is going a little slower now, a little slower." Margaret tried to get up again, failed, and forked the sign of the evil eye at her daughter. "A little slower, Mama. Do you know what the present is, Mama?"
"What you always wanted. Darkness. And whatever God lives there."
Margaret White whispered, "Our Father, who art in heaven." "Slower, Mama. Slower. Hallowed be thy name. I could see the blood draining back into you. Slower. Thy kingdom come. Your feet and hands like marble, like alabaster, white.
Thy will be done."
"My will, Mama. Slower. On earth, slower. As it..." She collapsed forward, hands twitching. "As it is in heaven."
Carrie whispered, "Full stop." She looked down at herself and put her hands weakly around the haft of the knife. "No. Oh, no, that hurts. That's too much hurt." She tried to get up, failed, then pulled herself up by Mama's stool. Dizziness and nausea washed over her. She could taste blood, bright and slick in the back of her throat. Smoke, acrid and choking, was drifting in through the windows now. The flames had reached next door. Even now, sparks would be lighting softly on the roof that rocks had punched brutally through 1,000 years before. Carrie went out the back door, staggered across the lawn, and rested. "Where's my mama?" Against a tree. There was something she was supposed to do. Something about roadhouses, parking lots, the angel with the sword, the fiery sword. Never mind. It would come to her. She crossed by backyards to Willow Street and then crawled up the embankment to Route 6. It was 1:15 a.m. It was 11:20 p.m. when Christine Hargensen and Billy Nolan got back to the Cavalier. They went up the back stairs, down the hall, and before she could do more than turn on the lights, he was yanking at her blouse. "For God's sakes, let me unbutton it. To hell with that." He ripped it suddenly down the back. The cloth tore with a sudden hard sound. One button popped free and winked on the bare wood floor. Honky-tonkin' music came faintly up to them, and the building vibrated subtly with the clumsy, enthusiastic dancing of farmers and truckers and mill workers and waitresses and hairdressers, of the greasers and their towny girlfriends from Westover and Lewiston. "Hey!" "Be quiet!" He slapped her, rocking her head back. Her eyes took on a flat and deadly shine. "This is the end, Billy!" She backed away from him, breast swelling into her bra, flat stomach pumping, legs long and tapering in her jeans, but she backed toward the bed. "It's over!" "Sure," he said. He lunged for her, and she punched him, a surprisingly hard punch that landed on his cheek. He straightened and twitched his head a little. "You gave me a shiner, you bitch. I'll give you more. You're goddamn right you will." They stared at each other, panting, glaring. Then he began to unbutton his shirt, a little grin beginning on his face. "We got it on, Charlie. We really got it on." He called her Charlie whenever he was pleased with her. It seemed to be, she thought with a cold blink of humor, a generic term for good cunt. She felt a little smile come to her own face, relaxed a little, and that was when he whipped his shirt across her face and came in low, butting her in the stomach like a goat, tipping her onto the bed. The spring screamed. She pounded her fists helplessly on his back. "Get off me! Get off me! Get off me, you fucking greaseball! Get off me!" He was grinning at her, and with one quick, hard yank, her zipper was broken, her hips free. "Call your daddy," he was grunting. "That's what you gonna do? Huh? Huh? That it, old Chucky? Call big old legal beagle daddy, huh? I would have done it to you, you know that. I would have dumped it all over your fucking squash, you know it? Huh? Know it? Pig blood for pigs, right? Right on your motherfucking squash, you..." She had suddenly ceased to resist. He paused, staring down at her, and she had an odd smile on her face. "You wanted it this way all along, didn't you, you miserable little scumbag? That's right, isn't it? You creepy little one-nut, low-cock, dinkless wonder." His grin was slow, crazed. "It doesn't matter." "No," she said, "it doesn't." Her smile suddenly vanished. The cords on her neck stood out as she hawked back and spit in his face. They descended into a red, thrashing unconsciousness. Downstairs, the music thumped and wheezed. I'm popping little white pills and my eyes are open wide. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. CW, full throttle, very loud, very bad, 5-man band wearing sequin cowboy shirts and new peg jeans with bright rivets, occasionally wiping mixed sweat and Vitalis from their brows, lead guitar, rhythm, steel, dobro guitar, drums. No one heard the town whistle, or the first explosion, or the second. And when the gas main blew and the music stopped and someone drove into the parking lot and began to yell the news, Chris and Billy were asleep. Chris woke suddenly, and the clock on the night table said 1:05. Someone was pounding on the door. "Billy!" the voice was yelling. "Get up! Hey! Hey!" Billy stirred, rolled over, and knocked the cheap alarm clock onto the floor.
"What the Christ!"
he said thickly, and sat up. His back stung. The bitch had covered it with long scratches. He'd barely noticed it at the time, but now he decided he was going to have to send her home bow-legged, just to show her who was but... Silence struck him. Silence. The Cavalier did not close until 2. As a matter of fact, he could still see the neon twinkling and flicking through the dusty garret window. Except for the steady pounding, something happened. The place was a graveyard.
"Billy! You in there? Hey!"
"Who is it?" Chris whispered. Her eyes were glittering and watchful in the intermittent neon. "Jackie Talbot," he said absently, then raised his voice.
"What?"
"Let me in, Billy. I gotta talk to you." Billy got up and padded to the door, naked. He unlocked the old-fashioned hook and eye and opened it. Jackie Talbot burst inside. His eyes were wild and his face was smeared with soot. He had been drinking it up with Steve and Henry when the news came at 12:10. They had gone back to town in Henry's elderly Dodge convertible and had seen the Jackson Avenue gas main explode from the vantage point of Brickyard Hill. When Jackie had borrowed the Dodge and started to drive back at 12:30, the town was a panicky shambles.
"Chamberlain's burning up," he said to Billy. "Whole fucking town. The school's gone. The center's gone. West End blew up. Gas. And Carlin Street's on fire, and they're saying Carrie White did it."
"Oh, God," Chris said. She started to get out of bed and grope for her clothes. "What did..."
"Shut up," Billy said mildly, "or I'll kick your ass."
He looked at Jackie again and nodded for him to go on. "They seen her. Lots of people seen her. Billy, they say she's all covered with blood. She was at that fucking prom tonight. Steve and Henry didn't get it, but... Billy, did you... That pig blood. Was it..."
"Yeah," Billy said.
"Oh, no." Jackie stumbled back against the doorframe. His face was a sickly yellow in the light of the one hall light bulb. "Oh, Jesus, Billy. The whole town.
Carrie trashed the whole town? Carrie White? You're full of shit."
He said it calmly, almost serenely. Behind him, Chris was dressing rapidly.
"Go look out the window," Jackie said.
Billy went over and looked out. The entire eastern horizon had gone crimson, and the sky was alight with it. Even as he looked, 3 fire trucks screamed by. He could make out the names on them in the glow of the streetlight that marked the Cavalier's parking lot.
"Son of a whore," he said. "Those trucks are from Brunswick."
"Brunswick?" Chris said. "That's 40 miles away. That can't be." Billy turned back to Jackie Talbot.
"All right. What happened?"
Jackie shook his head. "Nobody knows. Not yet. It started at the high school. Carrie and Tommy Ross got the king and queen, and then somebody dumped a couple of buckets of blood on them, and she ran out. Then the school caught on fire, and they say nobody got out. Then Teddy's Amoco blew up. Then that mobile station on Summer Street..."
"Sitco," Billy corrected. "It's a Sitco."
"Who the fuck cares?" Jackie screamed. "It was her. Every place something happened, it was her. And those buckets...
None of us wore gloves.
I'll take care of it, Billy said.
You don't get it, Billy.
Carrie is...
Get out. Billy, get out or I'll break your arm and feed it to you.
Jackie backed out of the door warily.
Go home. Don't talk to nobody. I'm going to take care of everything.
All right, Jackie said.
Okay, Billy, I just thought...
Billy slammed the door. Chris was on him in a second.
Billy, what are we going to do? That bitch, Carrie, oh my Lord, what are we going to...
Billy slapped her, getting his whole arm into it, and knocked her onto the floor. Chris sat sprawled in stunned silence for a moment, and then held her face and began to sob. Billy put on his pants, his T-shirt, his boots. Then he went to the chipped porcelain washstand in the corner, clicked on the light, wet his head, and began to comb his hair, bending down to see his reflection in the spotted, ancient mirror. Behind him, wavy and distorted, Chris Hargensen sat on the floor, wiping blood from her split lip.
"I'll tell you what we're going to do," he said. "We're going into town and watch the fires. Then we're coming home. You're going to tell your dear old daddy that we were out to the Cavalier drinking beers when it happened. I'm going to tell my dear old mummy the same thing. Dig?"
"Billy, your fingerprints," she said. Her voice was muffled but respectful.
"Their fingerprints," he said. "I wore gloves."
"Would they tell?" she asked. "If the police took them in and questioned them?"
"Sure," he said. "They'd tell."
The loops and swirls were almost right. They glistened in the light of the dull, fly-specked globe like eddies in deep water. His face was calm, reposeful. The comb he used was a battered old ace, clotted with grease. His father had given it to him on his 11th birthday, and not one tooth was broken in it. Not one.
"Maybe they'll never find the buckets," he said. "If they do, maybe the fingerprints'll be burnt off, I don't know. But if Doyle takes any of them in, I'm heading for California. You do what you want."
"Would you take me with you?" she asked. She looked at him from the floor, her lip puffed to negroid size, her eyes pleading. He smiled.
"Maybe." But he wouldn't. Not anymore. "Come on, we're going to town."
They went downstairs and through the empty dance hall, where chairs were still pushed back and beers were standing flat on the tables. As they went through the fire door, Billy said, "This place sucks anyway." They got into his car and he started it up. When he popped on the headlights, Chris began to scream, hands and fists up to her cheeks. Billy felt it at the same time, something in his mind. Carrie, 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 Carrie. A presence. Carrie was standing in front of them, perhaps 70 feet away. The high beams picked her out in ghastly horror movie blacks and whites, dripping and clotted with blood. Now much of it was her own. The hilt of the butcher knife still protruded from her shoulder, and her gown was covered with dirt and grass stain. She had crawled much of the distance from Carlin Street, half fainting, to destroy this roadhouse, perhaps the very one where the doom of her creation had begun. She stood swaying, her arms thrown out like the arms of a stage hypnotist, and she began to totter toward them. It happened in the blink of a second. Chris had not had time to expend her first scream. Billy's reflexes were very good, and his reaction was instantaneous. He shifted into low, popped the clutch, and floored it. The Chevrolet's tires screamed against the asphalt, and the car sprang forward like some old and terrible man-eater. The figure swelled in the windshield, and as it did, the presence became louder. Carrie, 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 and louder. Carrie, 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 like a radio being turned up to full volume. Time seemed to close around them in a frame, and for a moment they were frozen even in motion. Billy,
Carrie, just like the dogs. Carrie, just like the goddamn dogs. Carrie, Brucey, I wish it could Carrie be Carrie you. And Chris, Carrie, Jesus, not to kill her. Carrie didn't mean to kill her. Carrie, Billy, I don't. Carrie went to Carrie, see it, and Carrie herself. See the wheel, car, wheel, gas, pedal, wheel. I see the wheel. Oh, God, my heart, my heart, my heart. And Billy suddenly felt his car turn traitor, come alive, slither in his hands. The Chevy dug around in a smoking half-circle, straight pipes racketing, and suddenly the clabbered side of the Cavalier was swelling, 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 and this is. They slammed into it at 40, still accelerating, and wood sprayed up in a neon-tinted detonation. Billy was thrown forward, and the steering column speared him. Chris was thrown into the dashboard. The gas tank split open, and fuel began to puddle around the rear of the car. Part of one straight pipe fell into it, and the gas bloomed into flame. Carrie lay on her side, eyes closed, panting thickly. Her chest was on fire. She began to drag herself across the parking lot, going nowhere.
Mama, I'm sorry it all went wrong. Oh, Mama, oh, please, I hurt so bad, Mama, what do I do?
And suddenly it didn't seem to matter anymore. Nothing would matter. If she could turn over, and see the stars, turn over, and look once, and die. And that was how Sue found her at 2 o'clock. When Sheriff Doyle left her, Sue walked down the street and sat on the steps of the Chamberlain U. Washit. She stared at the burning sky without seeing it. Tommy was dead. She knew it was true and accepted it with an ease that was dreadful. And Carrie had done it. She had no idea how she knew it, but the conviction was as pure and right as arithmetic. Time passed. It didn't matter. Macbeth hath murdered sleep, and Carrie hath murdered time. Pretty good. A bon mot. Sue smiled dolefully. Can this be the end of our heroine? Miss Sweet Little 16? No worries about the country club and clean corners now? Not ever. Gone. Burned out. Someone ran past, blabbering that Carlin Street was on fire. Good for Carlin Street. Tommy was gone, and Carrie had gone home to murder her mother. She sat bolt upright, staring into the darkness. She didn't know how she knew. It bore no relationship to anything she had ever read about telepathy. There were no pictures in her head, no great white flashes of revelation. Only prosaic knowledge, the way you know summer follows spring, that cancer can kill you, that Carrie's mother was dead already, that her heart rose thickly in her chest. Dead? She examined her knowledge of the incident, trying to disregard the insistent weirdness of knowing from nothing. Yes, Margaret White was dead. Something to do with her heart. But she had stabbed Carrie. Carrie was badly hurt. She was... There was nothing more. She got up and ran back to her mother's car. 10 minutes later, she parked on the corner of Branch and Carlin Street, which was on fire. No trucks were available to fight the blaze yet, but sawhorses had been put across both ends of the street, and greasily smoking road pots lit a sign which said, Danger! Live wires! Sue cut through 2 backyards and forced her way through a budding hedge that scraped at her with short, stiff bristles. She came out 1 yard from the White's house and crossed over. The house was in flames, the roof blazing. It was impossible to even think about getting close enough to look in. But in the strong firelight, she saw something better, the splashed trail of Carrie's blood. She followed it with her head down,
past the larger spots where Carrie had rested, through another hedge, across a Willow Street backyard, and then through an undeveloped tangle of scrub pine and oak. Beyond that, a short, unpaved spur, little more than a footpath, wound up the rise of land to the right, angling away from Route 6. She stopped suddenly as doubt struck her with vicious and corrosive force. Suppose she could find her? What then? Heart failure? Set on fire? Controlled and forced to walk in front of an oncoming car or fire engine? Her peculiar knowledge told her Carrie would be capable of all these things. Find a policeman. She giggled a little at that one and sat down in the grass, which was silked with dew. She had already found a policeman, and even supposing Otis Doyle had believed her, what then? A mental picture came to her of 100 desperate manhunters surrounding Carrie, demanding her to hand over her weapons and give up. Carrie obediently raises her hands and plucks her head from her shoulders, hands it to Sheriff Doyle, who solemnly puts it in a wicker basket marked People's Exhibit A. And Tommy's dead. Well, she began to cry. She put her hands over her face and sobbed into them. A soft breeze snuffled through the juniper bushes on top of the hill. More fire engines screamed by on Route 6, like huge red hounds in the night. The town's burning down. Oh, well. She had no idea how long she sat there, crying in a grainy half-doze. She was not even aware that she was following Carrie's progress toward the Cavalier, no more than she was aware of the process of respiration unless she thought about it. Carrie was hurt very badly, was going on brute determination alone at this point. It was 3 miles out to the Cavalier, even cross-country, as Carrie was going. Sue watched, thought, doesn't matter. As Carrie fell in a brook and dragged herself out, icy and shivering. It was really amazing that she kept going. But of course it was for Mama. Mama wanted her to be the angel's fiery sword to destroy. She's going to destroy that too. She got up and began to run clumsily, not bothering to follow the trail of blood. She didn't need to follow it anymore. From The Shadow Exploded, pages 164 through 165. Whatever any of us may think of the Carrie White affair, it is over. It's time to turn to the future. As Dean McGuffin points out in his excellent Science Yearbook article, if we refuse to do this, we will almost certainly have to pay the piper, and the price is apt to be a high one. A thorny moral question is raised here. Progress is already being made toward complete isolation of the TK gene. It is more or less assumed in the scientific community. See, for instance, Bork and Hannigan's A View Toward Isolation of the TK Gene with Specific Recommendations for Control Parameters in Microbiology Annual, Berkeley, 1982, that when a testing procedure is established, all school-aged children will undergo the test as routinely as they now undergo the TB skin patch. Yet TK is not a germ. It is as much a part of the afflicted person as the color of his eyes. If overt TK ability occurs as a part of puberty, and if this hypothetical TK test is performed on children entering the first grade, we shall certainly be forewarned. But in this case, is forewarned forearmed? If the TB test shows positive, a child can be treated or isolated. If the TK test shows positive, we have no treatment except a bullet in the head. And how is it possible to isolate a person who will eventually have the power to knock down all walls? And even if isolation could be made successful, would the American people allow a small, pretty girl child to be ripped away from her parents at the first sign of puberty, to be locked in a bank vault for the rest of her life? I doubt it, especially when the White Commission has worked so hard to convince the public that the nightmare in Chamberlain was a complete fluke. Indeed, we seem to have returned to square one. From the sworn testimony of Susan Snell, taken before the State Investigatory Board of Maine, from the White Commission Report, pages 306 through 472. Question. Now, Miss Snell, the board would like to go through your testimony concerning your alleged meeting with Carrie White in the Cavalier parking lot. Answer. Why do you keep asking the same questions over and over? I've told you twice already. Question. We want to make sure the record is correct in every... Answer. You want to catch me in a lie. Isn't that what you really mean? You don't think I'm telling the truth, do you? Question. You say you came upon Carriott. Answer. Will you answer me? Question. At approximately 2 o'clock on the morning of May 28th. Is that correct? Answer. I'm not going to answer any more questions until you answer the one I just asked. Question. Miss Snell, this body is empowered to cite you for contempt if you refuse to answer on any other grounds than constitutional ones. Answer. I don't care what you're empowered to do. I've lost someone I love. Go and throw me in jail. I don't care. Go to hell. All of you, go to hell. You're trying to crucify me or something. Just lay off me. A short recess. Question. Miss Snell, are you willing to continue your testimony at this time? Answer. Yes. But I won't be badgered, Mr. Chairman. Question. Of course not, young lady. No one wants to badger you. Now, you claim to have come upon Carrie in the parking lot of this tavern at about 2 o'clock. Is that correct? Answer. Yes. Question. You knew the time. Answer. I was wearing the watch you see on my wrist right now. Question. To be sure. Isn't the Cavalier better than 6 miles from where you left your mother's car? Answer. It is by the road. It's closer to 3 as the crow flies. Question. You walked this distance? Answer. Yes. Question. Now, you testified earlier that you knew you were getting close to Carrie. Can you explain this? Answer. No. Question. Could you smell her? Answer. What? Question. Did you follow your nose? Laughter in the galleries. Answer. Are you playing games with me? Question. Answer the question, please. Answer. No, I didn't follow my nose. Question. Could you see her? Answer. No. Question. Hear her? Answer. No. Question. Then how could you possibly know she was there? Answer. How did Tom Quillen know? Or Cora Simmard? Or poor Vic Mooney? How did any of them know? Question. Answer the question, miss. This is hardly the place or the time for impertinence. Answer. But they did say they just knew, didn't they? I read Mrs. Simmard's testimony in the paper. And what about the fire hydrants that opened themselves and the gas pumps that broke their own locks and turned themselves on? The power lines that climbed down off their poles and... Question. Miss Snell, please. Answer. Those things are in the record of this commission's proceedings. Question. That is not an issue here. Answer. Then what is? Are you looking for the truth or just a scapegoat? Question. You deny you had prior knowledge of Carrie White's whereabouts? Answer. Of course I do. It's an absurd idea. Question. Oh? And why is it absurd? Answer. Well,
If you're suggesting some kind of conspiracy, it's absurd, because Carrie was dying when I found her. It could not have been an easy way to die. Question, if you had no prior knowledge of her whereabouts, how could you go directly to her location? Answer, oh, you stupid man! Have you listened to anything that's been said here? Everybody knew it was Carrie. Anyone could have found her if they had put their minds to it. Question, but not just anyone found her. You did. Can you tell us why people did not show up from all over, like iron filings drawn to a magnet? Answer, she was weakening rapidly. I think that perhaps the zone of her influence was shrinking. Question, I think you will agree that that is a relatively uninformed supposition. Answer, of course it is. On the subject of Carrie White, we're all relatively uninformed. Question, have it your way, Miss Snell. Now if we could turn to... At first, when she climbed up the embankment between Henry Drain's meadow and the parking lot of the Cavalier, she thought Carrie was dead. Her figure was halfway across the parking lot, and she looked oddly shrunken and crumpled. Sue was reminded of dead animals she had seen on 95, woodchucks, groundhogs, skunks, that had been crushed by speeding trucks and station wagons. But the presence was still in her mind, vibrating stubbornly, repeating the call letters of Carrie White's personality over and over. An essence of Carrie, a gestalt, muted now, not strident, not announcing itself with a clarion, but waxing and waning in steady oscillations, unconscious. Sue climbed over the guardrail that bordered the parking lot, feeling the heat of the fire against her face. The Cavalier was a wooden frame building, and it was burning briskly. The charred remains of a car were limned in flame to the right of the back door. Carrie had done that then. She did not go to look and see if anyone had been in it. It didn't matter. Not now. She walked over to where Carrie lay on her side, unable to hear her own footsteps under the hungry crackle of the fire. She looked down at the curled-up figure with a bemused and bitter pity. The knife hilt protruded cruelly from her shoulder, and she was lying in a small pool of blood. Some of it was trickling from her mouth. She looked as if she had been trying to turn herself over when unconsciousness had taken her. Able to start fires, pull down electric cables, able to kill almost by thought alone, lying here, unable to turn herself over. Sue knelt, took her by one arm and the unhurt shoulder, and gently turned her onto her back. Carrie moaned thickly, and her eyes fluttered. The perception of her in Sue's mind sharpened, as if a mental picture was coming into focus. Who's there? And Sue, without thought, spoke in the same fashion. Me, Sue Snell. Only there was no need to think of her name. The thought of herself as herself was neither words nor pictures. The realization suddenly brought everything up close, made it real, and compassion for Carrie broke through the dullness of her shock. And Carrie, with faraway, dumb reproach, "You tricked me. You all tricked me." Carrie, I don't even know what happened. Is Tommy? You tricked me. That happened. Trick, trick, trick. Oh, dirty trick. The mixture of image and emotion was staggering, indescribable. Blood, sadness, fear. The latest dirty trick in a long series of dirty tricks. They flashed by in a dizzying shuffle that made Sue's mind reel helplessly, hopelessly. They shared the awful totality of perfect knowledge. Carrie, don't.
Don't. Hurts me.
Now the girl's throwing sanitary napkins, chanting, laughing. Sue's face mirrored in her own mind, ugly, caricatured, all mouth, cruelly beautiful.
See the dirty trick, see my whole life, one long dirty trick. Look, Carrie, look inside me.
And Carrie looked.
The sensation was terrifying. Her mind and nervous system had become a library. Someone in desperate need ran through her, fingers trailing lightly over shelves of books, lifting some out, scanning them, putting them back, letting some fall, leaving the pages to flutter wildly. Glimpses, that's me as a kid. Hate him, Daddy. Oh, Mommy, wipe lips. Oh, teeth, Bobby, pushed me. Oh, my knee. Car, want to ride in the car. We're going to see Aunt Cicely. Mommy, come quick. I made pee. In the wind of memory and still on and on, finally reaching a shelf marked Tommy, subheaded prom. Books thrown open, flashes of experience, marginal notations and all the hieroglyphs of emotion. More complex than the Rosetta Stone. Looking, finding more than Sue herself had suspected. Love for Tommy, jealousy, selfishness, a need to subjugate him to her will on the matter of taking Carrie. Disgust for Carrie herself, hate for Miss Disjardin, hate for herself. She could take better care of herself. She does look just like a goddamn toad. But no ill will for Carrie personally, no plan to get her in front of everyone and undo her. The feverish feeling of being raped in her most secret corridors began to fade. She felt Carrie pulling back, weak and exhausted. Why didn't you just leave me alone? Carrie, Mama would be alive. I kill my mama. I want her. Oh, it hurts. My chest hurts. My shoulder. Oh, I want my mama. Carrie,
And there was no way to finish that thought, nothing there to complete it with. Sue was suddenly overwhelmed with terror, the worse because she could put no name to it. The bleeding freak on this oil-stained asphalt suddenly seemed meaningless and awful in its pain and dying.
Oh, Mama, I'm scared, Mama!
Sue tried to pull away, to disengage her mind, to allow Carrie at least the privacy of her dying, and was unable to. She felt that she was dying herself and did not want to see this preview of her own eventual end.
Carrie, let me go! Mama!
The mental scream reached a flaring, unbelievable crescendo and then suddenly faded. For a moment, Sue felt as if she were watching a candle flame disappear down a long, black tunnel at a tremendous speed.
She's dying. Oh, my God. I'm feeling her die.
And then the light was gone, and the last conscious thought had been,
Mama, I'm sorry. Where?
And it broke up. And Sue was tuned in only on the blank idiot frequency of the physical nerve endings that would take hours to die. She stumbled away from it, holding her arms out in front of her like a blind woman toward the edge of the parking lot. She tripped over the knee-high guardrail and tumbled down the embankment. She got to her feet and stumbled into the field, which was filling with mystic white pockets of ground mist. Crickets chirruped mindlessly and a whippoorwill.
Whippoorwill, somebody's dying,
called in the great stillness of morning. She began to run, breathing deep in her chest, running from Tommy, from the fires and explosions, from Carrie, but mostly from the final horror. That last lighted thought carried swiftly down into the black tunnel of eternity, followed by the blank idiot hum of prosaic electricity. The after image began to fade reluctantly, leaving a blessed cool darkness in her mind that knew nothing. She slowed, halted, and became aware that something had begun to happen. She stood in the middle of the great and misty field, waiting for realization. Her rapid breathing slowed, caught suddenly as if on a thorn, and suddenly vented itself in one howling, cheated scream. As she felt the slow course of dark menstrual blood down her thighs.
Part 3. Wreckage.
Westover Mercy Hospital, report of decease, by R.M. Name, White, Carrietta Inn. Address, 47 Carlin Street, Chamberlain, Maine, 02249. Emergency room, none. Ambulance, number 16. Treatment administered, none. DOA, yes. Time of death, May 28, 1979, 2 o'clock a.m., approximately. Cause of death, hemorrhage, shock, coronary occlusion, and or coronary thrombosis, possible. Person identifying deceased, Susan D. Snell, 19 Back Chamberlain Road, Chamberlain, Maine, 02249. Next of kin, none. Body to be released to, State of Maine. Doctor in attendance, Harold Kubler, M.D. Pathologist, F.M. From the National AP ticker, Friday, June 5th, 1979. Chamberlain, Maine, AP. State officials say that the death toll in Chamberlain stands at 409, with 49 still listed as missing. Investigation concerning Carrietta White and the so-called TK phenomena continues amid persistent rumors that an autopsy on the White girl has uncovered certain unusual formations in the cerebrum and cerebellum of the brain. This state's governor has appointed a Blue Ribbon Committee to study the entire tragedy. Ends. Final. June 5, 0303 in AP. From the Lewiston Daily Sun, Sunday, September 7th, page 3. The legacy of TK, scorched earth and scorched hearts. Chamberlain. Prom night is history now. Pundits have been saying for centuries that time heals all wounds. But the hurt of this small western Maine town may be mortal. The residential streets are still there on the town's east side, guarded by graceful oaks that have stood for 200 years. The trim salt boxes and ranch stiles on Morin Street and Brickyard Hill are still neat and undamaged. But this New England pastoral lies on the rim of a blackened and shattered hub, and many of the neat houses have for sale signs on their front lawns. Those still occupied are marked by black wreaths on the front doors. Bright yellow Allied vans and orange U-Hauls of varying sizes are a common sight on Chamberlain streets these days. The town's major industry, Chamberlain Mills and Weaving, still stands, untouched by the fire that raged over much of the town on those 2 days in May. But it has only been running one shift since June 4th, and according to Mill President William A. Chambly, further layoffs are a strong possibility. "We have the orders," Chambly said, "but you can't run a mill without people to punch the time clock. We don't have them. I've gotten notice from 34 men since August 15th. The only thing we can see to do now is close up the dye house and job our work out. We'd hate to let the men go, but this thing is getting down to a matter of financial survival." Roger Fearon has lived in Chamberlain for 22 years and has been with the mill for 18 of those years. He has risen during that time from a third-floor bagger making 73 cents an hour to dye house foreman, yet he seems strangely unmoved by the possibility of losing his job. "I'd lose a damn good wage," Fearon said. "It's not something you take lightly. The wife and I have talked it over.
We could sell the house. It's worth $20,000 easy. And although we probably won't realize half of that, we'll probably go ahead and put it up. Doesn't matter. We don't really want to live in Chamberlain anymore. Call it what you want, but Chamberlain has gone bad for us. Fearon is not alone. Henry Kelly, proprietor of a tobacco shop and soda fountain called the Kelly Fruit until prom night leveled it, has no plans to rebuild. The kids are gone, he shrugs. If I opened up again, there'd be too many ghosts and too many corners. I'm going to take the insurance money and retire to St. Petersburg. A week after the tornado of 54 had cut its path of death and destruction through Worcester, the air was filled with the sound of hammers, the smell of new timber, and a feeling of optimism and human resilience. There is none of that in Chamberlain this fall. The main road has been cleared of rubble, and that is about the extent of it. The faces that you meet are full of dull hopelessness. Men drink beer without talking in Frank's Bar on the corner of Sullivan Street, and women exchange tales of grief and loss in backyards. Chamberlain has been declared a disaster area, and money is available to help put the town back on its feet and begin rebuilding the business district. But the main business of Chamberlain in the last 4 months has been funerals. 440 are now known dead, 18 more still unaccounted for, and 67 of the dead were UN high school seniors on the verge of graduation. It is this, perhaps, more than anything else, that has taken the guts out of Chamberlain. They were buried on June 1st and 2nd in three mass ceremonies. A memorial service was held on June 3rd in the town square. It was the most moving ceremony that this reporter has ever witnessed. Attendance was in the thousands, and the entire assemblage was still as the school band, stripped from 56 to a bare 40, played the school song and taps. There was a somber graduation ceremony the following week at neighboring Motton Academy, but there were only 52 seniors left to graduate. The valedictorian, Henry Stample, broke into tears halfway through his speech and could not continue. There were no graduation night parties following the ceremony. The seniors merely took their diplomas and went home. And still, as the summer progressed, the hearses continued to roll as more bodies were discovered. To some residents, it seemed that each day the scab was ripped off again so that the wound could bleed afresh. If you are one of the many curiosity seekers who have been through Chamberlain in the last week, you have seen a town that may be suffering from terminal cancer of the spirit. A few people, looking lost, wander through the aisles of the A&P. The Congregational Church on Carlin Street is gone, swept away by fire, but the brick Catholic Church still stands on Elm Street, and the trim Methodist Church on Outer Main Street, although singed by fire, is unhurt. Yet attendance has been poor. The old men still sit on the benches in Courthouse Square, but there is little interest in the checkerboards or even in conversation. The overall impression is one of a town that is waiting to die. It is not enough these days to say that Chamberlain will never be the same. It may be closer to the truth to say that Chamberlain will simply never again be. Excerpt from a letter dated June 9th from Principal Henry Grail to Peter Philpott, Superintendent of Schools. And so I feel I can no longer continue in my present position, feeling as I do that such a tragedy might have been averted if I had only had more foresight. I would like you to accept my resignation effective as of July 1st, if this is agreeable to you and your staff. Excerpt from a letter dated June 11th from Rita Desjardin, Instructor of Physical Education, to Principal Henry Grail. Am returning my contract to you at this time.
I feel that I would kill myself before ever teaching again. Late at night, I keep thinking, if I had only reached out to that girl. If only. If only.
Found painted on the lawn of the house lot where the white bungalow had been located. Carrie White is burning for her sins. Jesus never fails. From Telekinesis, Analysis and Aftermath, Science Yearbook, 1981, by Dean D. L. McGuffin. In conclusion, I would like to point out the grave risk authorities are taking by burying the Carrie White affair under the bureaucratic mat, and I am speaking specifically of the so-called White Commission. The desire among politicians to regard TK as a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon seems very strong, and while this may be understandable, it is not acceptable. The possibility of a recurrence, genetically speaking, is 99%. It's time we planned now for what may be. From Slang Terms Explained, A Parent's Guide, by John R. Coombs, New York, The Lighthouse Press, 1985, page 73. To rip off a Carrie, to cause either violence or destruction, mayhem, confusion. 2. To commit arson. From Carrie White, 1963 to 1979. From The Shadow Exploded, page 201. Elsewhere in this book, mention is made of a page in one of Carrie White's school notebooks where a line from a famous rock poet of the 60s, Bob Dylan, was written repeatedly, as if in desperation. It might not be amiss to close this book with a few lines from another Bob Dylan song, lines that might serve as Carrie's epitaph. I wish I could write you a melody so plain that would save you, dear lady, from going insane, that would ease you and cool you and cease the pain of your useless and pointless knowledge. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 98. This little book is done now. I hope it sells well so I can go someplace where nobody knows me. I want to think things over, decide what I'm going to do between now and the time when my light is carried down that long tunnel into blackness. From the conclusion of the State Investigatory Board of Maine in connection with the events of May 27th, 28th, in Chamberlain, Maine. And so we must conclude that, while an autopsy performed on the subject indicates some cellular changes, which may indicate the presence of some paranormal power, we find no reason to believe that a recurrence is likely or even possible. Excerpt from a letter dated May 3, 1988, from Amelia Jenks, Royal Knob, Tennessee, to Sandra Jenks, Macon, Georgia. And your little niece is growing like a weed, awful big for only two. She has blue eyes like her daddy and my blonde hair, but that'll probably go dark. Still, she is awful pretty, and I think sometimes when she is asleep how she looks like our mama. The other day while she was playing in the dirt beside the house, I sneaked around and saw the funniest thing. Annie was playing with her brother's marbles, only they were moving around all by themselves. Annie was giggling and laughing, but I was a little scared. Some of them marbles was going right up and down. It reminded me of Grandma. Do you remember when the law came up that time after Pete and their guns flew out of their hands and Grammy just laughed and laughed? And she used to be able to make her rocker go even when she wasn't in it. Gave me a real bad turn to think on it. I sure hope she don't get heart spells like Grammy did. Remember? Well, I must go and do a wash, so give my best to Rich and take care to send us some pictures when you can. Still, our Annie is awful pretty, and her eyes are as bright as buttons. I bet she'll be a world beater someday. All my love,
Melia.
Carrie was written by Stephen King and read by Sissy Spacek. It was recorded at Crystal Phonics Studios in Charlottesville, Virginia, with editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsberg. Carrie was produced and directed by Kelly Gilday. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.